This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Countdown till potential default, 13 days.
So what is Washington going to do?
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Steve Chiotakis. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org, our podcast. It's Wednesday, July 20th.
Coming up, there are some different plans on the table in D.C. Which one will emerge at the end of the day to raise the debt ceiling and avoid default?
Also, American Airlines gets a little less American.
Russia picks up the slack in the space industry.
And how much you trust your boss might depend on how old you are. Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
President Obama and Congress have until August 2nd, that's just under 2 weeks, to come up with a debt limit compromise, or the Treasury Department says the U.S. will likely default. Now, we're getting details and reaction today about a bipartisan proposal from a group of senators. These senators are calling themselves the Gang of Six, to raise the debt ceiling while cutting $3.7 trillion out of the deficit over the next 10 years. Marketplace's Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale is with us now to talk about it this morning. Morning, John.
Good morning, Steve.
So how is the Gang of Six plan unveiled yesterday different from other plans that we've heard about?
Well, it is a big, comprehensive plan, and it has at least some bipartisan support. Not all the details are spelled out yet, but over 10 years, it cuts a lot of spending, including for major entitlement programs like Medicare, and it raises some tax revenue from reforms, loophole closings, allowing the Bush tax cuts on the wealthy to expire. President Obama finds a lot to like.
It would not match perfectly with some of the approaches that we've taken, but I think that we're in the same playing field.
But, John, we have less than 2 weeks to go until that Treasury-imposed debt ceiling deadline. Do we have time to turn this four-page outline into law?
No. This is really complicated. It requires a lot of delicate language in a very politically charged atmosphere. It would take a short-term debt ceiling extension to give Congress more time.
And the stock markets had their best day of the year yesterday. Does that mean, John, investors are betting on a deal?
There's a lot of early momentum behind the deal, but I fear that it's mostly wishful thinking or hoping that a big compromise is possible. As the details come out and people realize that this is just too much heavy lifting, I think that optimism will be tempered. Remember, there is a plan B from Senate leaders to do the minimum necessary to avoid default.
All right. Marketplace's John Dimsdale in Washington. John, thanks.
You're welcome.
Now let's get some analysis from Richard DeKayser. He's an economist with the Parthenon Group, and he joins us from Boston, as he does every Wednesday. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Richard, we've got a couple plans on the table. What do you think's going to happen?
Well, it really looks like the plan with the best chance is this so-called grand bargain struck by the Gang of Six yesterday. And the reason I say that is half of the Senate, with equal numbers of Democrats and Republicans, already came out in support of it. That gives it a bipartisan hue and really makes it difficult for others to go their own way, given that it's got this cohesiveness. So that looks like the big deal, and it is truly big, but it's complicated. Part A of this plan is to legislate immediate cost spending reductions, that is, in the next 12 days before the debt ceiling is increased, and then Part B is much more complicated. It has lots of proposals to do many more important but complicated long-term things, including essentially restructuring the U.S. tax code.
And that would happen over how long of a period of time?
Well, it's not clear, but presumably between now and between election season, November of next year. It hasn't been spelled out in any detail, but that's part of the overall plan that people would be voting on, not the legislation itself, but presumably guidelines that would implement that legislation between now and election day.
And you think that they're going to be able to make all these tough decisions over the next 12, 18 months or so?
I don't know. And this really this comes down to the issue of enforcement. Is the legislation to increase the debt ceiling written in such a manner as to provide strict enforcement mechanisms so that they must reach these objectives? Or if it's kind of wishy-washy, you could easily see it bogging down in an election year, which are generally not known for getting things done.
Richard DeKayser, economist with the Parthenon Group, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
This morning, American Airlines announced the largest aircraft order in history. It is buying 460 new planes. But they won't be all made by Boeing, which has had an exclusive deal with American for the last 15 years. Now, the order will be split between U.S.-based Boeing and its European rival, Airbus.
Let's find out what's going on now from Seth Kaplan of the industry publication Airline Weekly. He is with us from Fort Lauderdale. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
So American Airlines has been exclusively a Boeing customer for 15 years. Why this change?
Well, they want a lot of new airplanes, and in particular, they want some fuel-efficient airplanes to replace some of the planes that are getting up there in years. Airbus is offering a new engine option for its older A320s, so same airplane but new engines that are going to be a lot more efficient, and American's very interested in that.
So it actually makes more financial sense for American to buy all new fuel-efficient aircraft to save money on fuel?
Just that more fuel-efficient cars right now are actually more expensive. So to burn less gas, you're going to have to pay more up front for the car. Well, it's the same with airplanes. American's going to pay a lot more for these airplanes than it would for less fuel-efficient airplanes. So whether or not in the long run it will save money, that we'll see. But certainly if fuel prices stay high, it will be relatively smart to have gone ahead and purchased the more efficient plane.
What is it that Airbus is doing that Boeing isn't doing?
Boeing has been thinking about whether to actually build a whole new airplane, which would likely be even better than what Airbus is offering right now. But for now, Airbus has at least updated the engines. Airlines are saying, well, that's better than nothing. We need more fuel-efficient planes. And these, in fact, are more fuel-efficient than anything else that's on the market.
Seth Kaplan of Airline Weekly, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, over in Europe now, leaders say a debt crisis summit there tomorrow could be a make-or-break moment for the future of the continent. Policymakers are meeting in Brussels tomorrow to come up with ways to entice investors into supporting yet another European bailout package.
And Apple, Steve, reported a record $7.3 billion profit for its latest quarter after the bell yesterday. Key numbers here, 9.3 million iPads. 20.3 million iPhones.
There's one more number I saw in the news today, $76 billion. You know what that means?
Huh.
Cash on hand at Apple.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing?
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
Now to the Marketplace Global perspective, the United Nations today formally declared a famine in parts of Somalia. The last time it did that was more than 30 years ago in Ethiopia. There is anarchy in Somalia.
Yeah, and the U.S. provided humanitarian support there in the 1990s, and that proved very, very difficult, as we remember. And today the U.S. government is reluctant to provide aid because of the presence of Al-Qaeda. Nevertheless, the UN says it needs hundreds of millions of dollars in the coming weeks. David Orr is spokesman for the UN's World Food Program. He's with us now from Nairobi, Kenya. Hi, David.
Hello there.
What exactly does an official famine declaration do? Does that mean there's more funding going in?
It has no direct legal implications, but it does mean there's more funding going in the sense that once a declaration of famine has been made, it secures tremendous media attention and, by consequence, lots of follow-up from donors and governments around the world.
What sort of aid does Somalia need from the U.S. and from other governments around the world?
Nearly half of the Somali population are now in crisis, and 2.8 of those are in the south. It's been pretty well off bounds to most humanitarian agencies since early last year. So it's a huge undertaking, and we're all obviously looking for donations from governments all over the world to respond to this crisis. We have a significant budget shortfall for this operation.
I know Somalia is a failed state. What about the logistics of getting aid to those who are in need? How will the aid get there?
It will be difficult, but not impossible. And once we secure the conditions that will allow us to operate in there in terms of security, access, not only to deliver, but also to monitor the distribution of food, then I think things will become a lot easier. And nothing is being ruled out. We're looking at everything from cross-border deliveries to airdrops at the moment.
David Orr with the World Food Program in Nairobi. David, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, several Chinese companies are planning to go public in the U.S. this week. Among them is Xunlei, China's third largest video streaming site. The site uses what's known as peer-to-peer technology to share music, movies, and software. Some are calling it China's Napster, but like Napster, there's a problem. Here's Marketplace's Rob Schmitz from Shanghai.
Lawyer Jack Chen logs into Xunlei and begins to download a movie.
The Chinese name of Avatar is Avanda.
10 seconds later, the movie begins. Xunlei gives 300 million people access to billions of songs, movies, and TV shows. Much of it, like this version of Avatar, is stolen. Greg Pilarowski heads Pillar Legal in Shanghai. He says Xunlei blatantly violates U.S. law, yet its name will soon appear on NASDAQ.
And that means that it's the U.S. capital markets that are actually going to fund the expansion of this company. And I think that that is of important interest to America. Should we open up our capital markets to companies whose business models would, in the United States, be illegal?
It's a question many lawyers are asking. Xunlei's been sued nearly 250 times in the past 3 years for copyright infringement. But history shows investors are more forgiving. Last year, another Chinese site carrying pirated movies went public in the U.S. It had the biggest one-day gain for a new IPO in 5 years. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
The space shuttle Atlantis is expected back on Earth tomorrow. That touchdown is going to mark the beginning of a new arrangement with Russia to get American astronauts to the International Space Station. That reliance means more than $1 billion for Russia's already cash-strapped space industry. From Moscow, here's reporter Peter Van Dyke.
Instead of touching down gracefully on home soil, NASA astronauts will now land with a bump in a Soyuz capsule. Russia's space agency is contracted to take astronauts to the space station through 2016. By then, one ticket will cost NASA $63 million. Russia has lots of plans for the money.
There are a number of new projects in manned space flight which had been started in previous 3-4 years, and those projects, they absolutely need a lot of funding.
Anatoly Zak is a journalist who runs the website Russian Space Web. While U.S. companies race to replace the shuttle, he says Russia must develop better spacecraft too.
Russian space industry absolutely needs to develop also new spacecraft which will match or exceed the capabilities of the new generation, U.S. or whoever comes online.
That won't be easy. The Soyuz rocket has not changed fundamentally since the 1960s. Former cosmonaut Georgi Grechko says it's time to move on.
I remember Khrushchev's expression that we make rockets like sausages. But if you eat even the best German sausages for 30 years, you get sick of them. We need to do something new.
The Soviets made and ate a lot of sausages, but you didn't eat them if you could afford better. 50 years after Yuri Gagarin's historic first flight, Russia's space industry has a chance to dine again at the top table. In Moscow, I'm Peter Van Dyke for Marketplace.
Steve, if you think our 9.2% unemployment rate is bad, just look at Spain. Theirs is more than 20%, and it's pushed a record number of families to default on their mortgages. Now, as the BBC's Sarah Rainsford reports from Madrid, protesters have come up with an unusual way of keeping people in their homes.
Almost every day, they're sending out notices on Twitter to form flash mobs and protest against the high number of foreclosures here. Crowds appear in front of a home, chanting and singing, and they block access to the property banks are trying to repossess. They've already forced the suspension of more than 60 foreclosures. The economic crisis has left almost 5 million Spaniards unemployed. That's what worries protesters like Eloy Morte.
In the first 3 months of the year, it's been around 15,000 families evicted from their houses. In Spain, there's a big crisis. The people have lost their jobs.
One reform the protesters demand is for banks to cancel all outstanding debt if a borrower hands over the keys to their property. Economists, though, warn that could cost the banks $5.5 billion, a real problem for Spain's financial sector, which is already shaky. In Madrid, I'm the BBC's Sarah Rainsford for Marketplace.
Today, a congressional committee is going to hear from patients and doctors and healthcare experts testifying about the standards the Food and Drug Administration uses to approve medical devices. As Marketplace's Gregory Warner reports from our health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, one researcher wants the FDA to start approving inferior devices.
The FDA approves medical devices it deems better than what's already on the market. Most of the debate this morning will focus on how the FDA makes those decisions. But according to a theory called disruptive innovation, the really good technology starts out inferior and improves over time.
The early versions of personal computers were toys. They weren't efficiency boosting. It took years of development.
Michael Mandel of the Progressive Policy Institute will tell Congress that the FDA should look for devices like those early computers that have the potential to transform healthcare.
You know, we want better health, but what we really need is treatments, devices that give us the same health using fewer workers.
Harold DeMonico directs the Innovation Support Center at Massachusetts General. He says encouraging efficiency isn't the FDA's job.
I don't think it's the FDA. I think it's the industry in and of itself.
But he says the industry isn't going to invent those efficient devices until the market demands them. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Well, now to something unhealthy. Steve, the Center for Science in the Public Interest has released its annual rankings of the worst for-you menu items at chain restaurants.
Oh, geez.
Here are some. Applebee's provolone stuffed meatballs with fettuccine, 1,520 calories and 2 days worth of saturated fat. Or the Cheesecake Factory's ultimate red velvet cake cheesecake, which is like eating a personal pan pepperoni pizza from Pizza Hut and 2 quarter pounders with cheese. Oh, and an additional day's worth of saturated fat.
So, yeah.
You know, I will say, by the way, I went to my favorite chain restaurant yesterday, Chili's, which was, I did not look at the nutritional information on what I was ordering, but it was delicious.
You live in California now, where you have the calorie counts on the menu.
That's right, yeah, but it doesn't mean we have to look at them.
No, we don't have to look at them. I'm sure a lot of people don't pay attention. Tomorrow marks 1 year to the day that President Obama signed the Dodd-Frank financial reform bill into law. Now, much of the Wall Street crackdown has yet to transpire, and Marketplace's Bob Moon reports special interests on both sides are still battling over efforts to put those new regulations into effect.
Like mosquitoes drawn to a swamp, financial industry lobbyists have been swarming Washington, looking to make the most of what's become a rulemaking bog.
There are 240-some rules that are required by the law, and that's really where the action is.
Bill Allison has been tracking the law's progress for the Sunlight Foundation, a lobbying watchdog group. He says Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Morgan Stanley topped the list of banks spending tens of millions to sway the law in their favor. Congress didn't actually write new rules, but left that to the regulators.
The agencies have logged over 2,100 meetings with outside parties interested in influencing these final rules.
And it's not just the banks.
There have been consumer groups, labor unions, and I think that that makes for a very, very slow process.
Regulators have fallen behind on 120 rulemaking deadlines due on the bill's anniversary, but Allison points out, look at all the work that's been created for the lobbyists in Washington.
In one way you can look at it as kind of a full employment act for K Street.
I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Well, tomorrow one of the biggest parts of the Dodd-Frank bill gets up and running, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the CFPB. For more on what that means for us consumers, let's bring in LA Times consumer columnist David Lazarus. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what is this CFPB going to be able to do?
Right out of the gate, it's going to be looking after credit cards. It's going to be looking after mortgages. It's going to be looking after a number of products like that that for many consumers can be very troublesome.
How would that be felt for me? If I go sign up for a new credit card, is there going to be something different that happens as a result of this agency?
Well, you won't have a CFPB person standing over your shoulder making sure that it all goes well, but you will have some recourse. For example, a lot of people are always contacting me saying, where should I turn if I have some problem? Here's the place now.
And they'll actually be able to do something about it.
Well, they say they will, but it's going to be a mixed bag at first. Some of their new powers, for example, payday loans, which have been largely unregulated in the past, that's a new critter. Well, they're not going to be able to regulate those until they have a director in place. And as we've been seeing on the political front, that's still kind of a coin toss.
Okay, well, let's zoom out a little bit. If this thing had been in place a few years ago, could it have really prevented the kind of crisis that we saw in housing or in lending or in any of the parts of the economy that went bad?
I would say yes. And the key reason here is that the other agencies that are out there that look after this industry, they're concerned first and foremost with the stability of the banking industry, not with the consumer. Here is an agency that looks at it completely from the other side and says, we're going to look at it from the consumer's point of view and make sure the consumer isn't hurt. So I would think that if anyone could have raised a red flag early on, these are the guys who could have done it.
But don't people have some personal responsibility for their decisions as a consumer?
Absolutely they do. And there's no question that the onus should be on all consumers to make sure that they're informed consumers and smart consumers. But that said, it's not a level playing field. There are businesses out there that will at times tilt things in their direction and, you know, maybe take advantage of people. When that happens, you want to make sure that there's a teacher in the room to split the kids apart.
LA Times consumer columnist David Lazarus, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Finally, Jeremy, David, there's a new survey out this month that says there's a big trust gap in the workplace. Merit's research found only 10%, like I couldn't believe this, 10% of all employees said they trust the management of their company in times of uncertainty. Huh. 10%. That means 9 out of 10 employees do not trust their management team in times of uncertainty. And I'm, you know, there are lots of, I guess, in the past couple, 3-4 years,
been a lot of uncertainty.
There's been a lot of uncertainty out there. A slightly better 14% of those employees said they think their management is ethical and honest. The highest percentage, Jeremy, of employees who trust the people for whom they work, I think it's like 16%, comes from the youngest age group poll, 18 to 24-year-olds.
The poor, sweet, naive youth.
The naive youth of today. You know, I used to think it was the rebellious youth, right? They're not going to trust
anymore.
Anybody. Not anymore, though. They're pretty much in with the boss. That's good.
In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. This is the Marketplace Midday Updates.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.